Whether you're a seasoned business leader or just starting out on your entrepreneurial journey, you'll have questions around how to navigate the complex and ever-changing business landscape. In Zuwani's At The Lake sessions, we discuss thought-provoking topics, exploring practical ways to align our day-to-day business activities with God's plans and purposes.
Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Welcome, everyone. To give you a little bit of insight into the word Zuwani, most of you, especially those from East Africa, will know that Zuwani means by the lake. It's a Swahili word. And so the whole idea and vision behind Zuwani is that this will be a place where you can come together like a lake. Be refreshed, be encouraged by one another, be filled with just revelation that God's giving around what he wants for us in the marketplace, and then going back out again into the work world and being able to be salt and light there. And so today is one of those moments where we get to come together as a community and really just grapple with some tough topics, think through things. Really trust that God is speaking through some of the people that are on this panel today, or all of the people that are on the panel today, and that we can come away feeling refreshed and challenged at the same time and go back into the marketplace and really just live full out and do things in a redemptive way in the spaces we're in. So this concept of having these At The Lake online events was birthed at our launch in 2021, where Champ de Kiesel, actually one of the panels at the conference was about diversity, and Champ actually put out a challenge to say, can we have more of these discussions? Can we have more panel discussions where we aren't scared to differ with one another and have some robust discussions, or together just get onto some of those thorny topics that we don't often talk about? And so that is exactly what's been happening over the last couple of sessions of At The Lake. This is our, I think it's our third or fourth At The Lake that we've had. So today's one is all about women in the marketplace. And we thought that it was appropriate since it is Women's Month globally. And so something that is really, really an important topic to chat through. So why do we want to talk about women in the marketplace? So according to the World Economic Forum, women currently make up 58% of Africa's self-employed population. And this is not accounting for those that are employed in the private and public sectors. So as leaders in business, we really need to provide an environment that considers the challenges faced by women, creating a space for women to be able to effectively manage all the different roles that we fulfill. Caretaker, nurturer, educator, entrepreneur, but also some of the ways of working, the ways of communicating are also important to consider as we engage as people in the marketplace, all trying to bring the gospel. So how do we do that in the best way? So in celebrating the contribution that women bring, we want to take a moment today as a panel and hopefully on the call together around what will support the flourishing of women at work. So we have our host today, Susanna Farr. She is the CEO of Gold Youth. Susanna, we have known for many, many years. Yeah, just an incredible friend, incredibly wise woman that I often go to for advice and insight, and just an entrepreneur in nature, such an entrepreneurial spirit, has been pioneering with the social enterprise called Gold Youth for many, many years. Susanna is currently based in Rwanda, has done work in multiple different areas in Southern Africa. And so really excited to hear about Susanna's journey and have her host our panel discussion today. So Suzanne, I'm going to hand over to you to introduce the rest of our incredible panel to our audience.
Thank you, Kerry, so much. I love the words you used of these thorny conversations. Yeah, today's topic is one of those thorny conversations that both my husband, Anthony, and I are very passionate about, but God is more passionate about that. And that's exciting for us as we step into today. We have an awesome panel, Irene Banda from Zambia. Welcome. She's the founder of Tukuza Associates Limited. And Irene is an entrepreneur. She's a strategist. She is a financial services expert, and she has a deep passion for transformative solutions that focus on wealth creation and poverty reduction solutions. So Irene, we're really excited to have you on the panel. Joining her, we have Sylvia Kithinji from Kenya. And Sylvia is a partner and she's head of corporate commercial for Ashitiva Associates, which is a limited liability partnership. And Sylvia's really played a critical role in Ashitiva's journey to create this impact-driven business. The team that she has supports a broad range of clients, from governments and development finance institutions to social impact enterprises, not-for-profits as well, right through to private equity funds and more. So we're looking forward to your wisdom, Sylvia, and your experience today. And then last but not least, Anthony Farr. Anthony is the CEO of Alan and Jill Gray Philanthropy in Africa. He's responsible for the execution of the Gray Philanthropy across the African continent. And before that, he was the founding CEO of the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation and the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation Endowment. And he's an amazing husband and father because I get to see him in action firsthand in that space. So welcome to our incredible panel. And I'd love to kick off the conversation with just asking each of you, Sylvia, if you don't mind, we can start with you. Tell us a little bit more about your background and your entrepreneurial or professional journey.
Thank you very much, Susanna. My story is interesting, Susanna. And if you don't mind, I'd just like to intertwine it with a little bit of my personal story. I started off my career here at Ashitiva Advocates, but there are certain things, some certain defining moments that have shaped my career and my professional life to date. I was born in a small town in Kenya called Meru to a mixed race family. And I recall very early on, before I knew concepts of justice or concepts of law, that I wanted to be a lawyer. And I've been asking myself for a very long time, why did I want to be a lawyer? And the only thing I remember is that I saw on TV a lady in a blue suit. And so, you know, as I grew up and everybody asked me, why did you want to be a lawyer? I didn't have a straight answer. And time came and went. And when I joined Ashitiva, the founding partner, Nelson Ashitiva, was very empowering. I was a first-year associate and he allowed me to pursue anything I wanted to do at the farm. At the time, the farm was just beginning. But there was some hunger in me that I wanted to do more. And I transitioned from Ashitiva at the time and moved to an all-female-led farm. And there's something interesting that drew me there. It was at a time, I think 2009 or thereabouts, and you wouldn't find female-led farms, especially African women, leading farms that are doing impact type of work. And by impact, I mean work that would make a difference to the country, work that would make a difference to clients at that scale level. And I had a good opportunity there. And to date, and that was almost 10 years ago, my feeling was these women were very inspiring. They were doing things only international law firms were doing. Local law firms were not even doing that. And of course, the respect that I had then, I still hold to date. And I wanted to do more impact work and impact work at scale. And so a friend of mine told me, you know what, Sylvia, you need to move to development and you'll be able to actually feel the impact that you're seeking to, to contribute to the world. And I did. And again, the story there was very interesting. Down that chain of the marketplace, so to speak, using Kerry's words, you'd have women at the top contributing significantly, women in the workplace, ordinary women in the workplace, and then the beneficiaries as well. And the interesting thing, Susanna, was the intersectionality and of the issues that those women face, both positive and negative. And so some of those things then created and still do create a lot of firepower in me to see, what the experience of women is in the workplace. I then transitioned back to Ashitiva out of a very strange conversation. I'll be speaking about this a little bit more later. I met Ashitiva and he asked me, oh, how have you been? This was 7 years later. And I told him I've been doing ABCD. And he said, well, Sylvia, I think we should be doing much more. I think you as a woman should be sitting on global boards and creating this kind of impact, creating systems and creating opportunities for women across the world, and not just women, actually, people across the world. And here I am today. And so as I've female lawyer and as a partner, where I sit today, I have that opportunity to curate what I want in terms of the work that I do. It's not just a source of livelihood. It's not just everyday work, but it's using that platform to create impact in one way or another. Thanks, Susanna, and that's my journey.
Wow. Thank you, Sylvia. So inspiring. I love that, to create what I want. And I guess just with that, the weightiness of influence that you have in that role. Thank you. Anthony.
Morning, everyone. So my journey started in finance, very passionate about finance and qualified as a chartered accountant and did all those good things. I was working at the time in London and became and was sent back to South Africa on secondment and became aware of the extent of the HIV/AIDS pandemic at the time. And spent some time with children that had been orphaned by the pandemic, and suddenly all my assumptions around the importance of finance and other things kind of crumbled before me, realizing that the country was going to have 2 million children that were going to be orphaned, and so that started a journey which took me into a very different direction, and ended up being involved in something called the Starfish Foundation, which was very much in the nonprofit sector to mobilize resources for that orphan generation. That Starfish Foundation continues to this day. But then where I find myself now with the Alan Gray Philanthropies is really after some time at the Starfish Foundation, kind of realizing that as much as that welfare was important and people needed shelter and food and basic education, it felt like there was more that was needed to truly transform these communities, higher levels of education, entrepreneurship, enterprise, and leadership. And so when I then came in contact with Mr. Alan Gray, and he started describing his vision for wanting to make that sort of contribution. It contained all those elements of higher levels of education, enterprise, and development, and so started a journey with the initially the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation, and now with the Alan and Joel Gray Philanthropies in Africa. But I suppose along that journey, if I look at the patterns there, at many of these stages, when one moved from the one stage to the other, for instance, that the Starfish Foundation, the people that came through and led the organizations beyond, there were these amazing ladies that came through and took the organization to greater levels. If I look at some of the succession that's happened in even Alan Gray Orbis Foundation, women that have taken the lead and taken it further in those opportunities. And so it struck me that you know, there's so much that we're missing if we don't allow for those opportunities and those possibilities as we realize the full potential of all of us in the work that needs to be done, the extraordinary amount of challenges that we all need to face, particularly in Africa.
Sure. Amazing. Thank you. Yeah, that's so inspiring and encouraging to see succession that you can honestly, with humility, say others have gone on ahead of you. And these are women to take that to that next level. Thanks for sharing that. Irene, over to you.
Thank you, Susanna. Good morning, everybody. So I started my career as a banker. My dad wanted me to be a nurse. I suppose it's because that was the profession that women would go for. But I was inspired when I saw bankers and how they were focused on what they were doing. And I was lucky enough to actually get a job in the bank. Now, as I worked in the bank, one of the things that happened in the bank is the interaction that I had with our clients. And that interaction helped me to understand how they crafted their businesses on paper. So if I was making an assessment or an appraisal for a facility, and I was looking at what was happening, what they had submitted in their application, then I would go to their place of business and really make those connections. Now, this began to speak to me in a very profound way because I was born in a family that was quite in the low income bracket. Didn't really know it then, but that's what it was. My father was an entrepreneur, so we all participated in making money. If he, my mother was knitting or crocheting what she was going to sell, we participated. If my father was hauling mangoes from the rurals to come and sell, we participated. He had minibuses and he would, there were nine of us. So we all had tasks. We would find ourselves in a minibus, being the conductor. And that was just life. The connection is that we then moved away from a high density area to a low density. My father managed to buy this house, but my heart really kept going back to the roots in the squatter settlements and looking at how people were sort of making a living and really just being troubled with the hand-to-mouth existence, with the lack of planning, with just worrying about what is on your nose and not necessarily how are we going to survive next year and the other year, what inheritance are we leaving. That did not quite happen. And so what happened when I was in the bank is I started really thinking about how do we reach down to the low-income people. Of course, it wasn't the strategy of my employer, so I was given permission to go and see if I could come up with a model that fits the low-income people. And I became one of the first movers. There were quite a number of us that started the whole idea of microfinance in Zambia. And with microfinance, of course, it just threw me into the mix of what's happening at the low-income level. And in my own career, I had never considered gender or women as an issue. Actually, I may even have been the other extreme where I just felt like, you know, just pull up your socks and do what needs to be done. Don't sell the woman conversation. I just wasn't in it until I really started interacting with women in the low income levels and started seeing the challenges. Some women would give them loans and they didn't want us to tell their husbands because that money would never be used appropriately. And we started having husbands complaining that their women are not, you know, subservient, and we were responsible for that. So this conversation just grew. And that really brought me in contact with the reality of the gender issues. And I actually started seeing some of it happening to me and recognizing that it was real. And of course, I came out of microfinance to set up what I'm working on now. And I am in the rural areas. And right there is another challenge that I'm having to deal with. And again, just bringing the gender issue to the fore. Reluctantly, as I was at the beginning, I am now beginning to see that there are indeed challenges that we need to work through. So I'm really glad to be part of this conversation, just to see what comes out of it.
Thanks, Irene. Thank you so much. So that's our power panel. And Irene, I love just also permeating throughout your story is the influence that your father had as an entrepreneur in the space he gave you to just become the entrepreneur that you are. And I think he has a woman that could be working anywhere, but has chosen to have that ground up system change approach. So I think we'll dig deep into conversation to hear more of that. So Anthony, I can't not notice this big elephant in the room behind you. So maybe we can start with you and talk about the elephant in the room. And I guess the topic at the lake that we are unpacking today, just looking at really the challenges that are faced by women in business and what we need to do to create environments where women can flourish in the marketplace. Why does this kind of topic almost elicit negative feelings or make people feel uncomfortable? If we're honest, we aren't having the men flocking to attend today. We've largely got the converted. What are your thoughts on that?
Thank you. I'm glad you noticed the elephant in the room. So this is a very important question. And I remember actually recently last year, the African Philanthropy Forum had their big annual gathering in Kigali in Rwanda. And essentially the entire program was built around this issue of gender and really wanting to make progress around gender. And I have to be honest that my first response to that probably was a little bit negative. Like I felt like, why is the whole conference on this? Like surely we could have an important element of it on this, but it felt at the time I was thinking, well, maybe it was extreme to have the whole thing related to this. And if I think of why even I kind of had that response at the time, I think there are a few things that come to mind. To finish that off, by the end of that conference, I kind of was in a completely different space in terms of understanding the importance and the reasoning for that programming. So if I think back to that, I think there are a couple of things that come to mind. The first is that, this is, we spoke at the beginning that this is difficult. We said it was kind of gnarly. There's so many dimensions to this. And I think naturally people are resistant to things that are difficult, that knowing that change needs to happen, but there's such entrenched systems around this, that it's easier for people to kind of step back from that and not actually have the courage and the boldness to fully engage, understanding that change is going to need to happen and it's going to be uncomfortable for people. So I think we need to kind of understand that that's going to be a response that we need to think through and how we manage that. The second is that I think there might be a lack of appreciation of actually how fundamental this is. So I mean, there can't be many bigger issues. There aren't many bigger issues than getting this right, because we are fundamentally kind of attacking and trying to move forward in the challenges of, in this case, the continent or beyond, kind of operating at way less of the potential than we should have. And there's so much opportunity. We heard already some of the statistics from the World Economic Forum and others. And so it's actually, I think people need to understand that this isn't just something that people are grandstanding about. It's actually fundamental to the progress that we need to make. And it's one of, if not the biggest lever that we can use to change things going forward. And then maybe the third and last point is that I think that there's this kind of incorrect assumption that when there are discussions like the ones that we're having today, that actually then that there's an incorrect assumption from the male side that actually maybe this is just a conversation that needs to happen among females, and I think that is fundamentally kind of wrong, and that needs to shift in terms of, this is a problem that we all need to be involved in, and it can't be solved by just the one side being involved in the conversations. It has to be done co-created together to understand and work together. And I think there's a kind of an immediate reaction that because it's a topic about women, it is only for women, and that needs to change.
Wow, I think a lot of takeouts there, but thank you for also sharing just your own revelation and resistance initially. And I guess we don't choose difficulty naturally. It often happens to us. But I think just this is the biggest lever for us to really shift the dial and to bring progress. So to all our men on the call, this is a conversation that we need to have at the forefront. I want to move into some of the realities that women are facing, and perhaps to both Irene and Sylvia. Tell us from your perspective, what are those realities that you are seeing in your day-to-day work that women are facing?
Sure. Irene, should I go first?
Please go first, Sylvia.
Great, thank you. Susanna, I must confess that I did have that conscious or unconscious bias, I'm not so sure, and also thought that the gender issue should not necessarily be mainstream, and that it was something that didn't deserve, for lack of a better word, the level of focus that it was getting. Now, let me speak to my experience as a lawyer and as an entrepreneur in law. So many women, if you look at the statistics in Kenya, the number of women versus men is pretty high. It's almost 50-50. It's at 44% women. 10 years ago, around 12 years ago, that number was lower. It was around 30%. Now, looking at that as a statistic, it's easy to say, look, we're doing well. we have the numbers and all that. But they still felt that there was a gap, although there was no specific intentionality around it. Now, just as recent as 2020, when COVID happened, International Development Law Organization did a study just to check what's the life of a legal entrepreneur like, specifically a woman. And it's so surprising that the issues that women face, say the women that Irene work with in rural areas, are the same issues that women in law practice, which is perceived as prestigious or stable, so to speak, the issues are pretty much the same. Now, in Kenya specifically, the legal profession is male-dominated, not from a numbers perspective, but from various other perspectives. And I'll start from simply the core, the stereotypes that are there. If you're a woman working in law in Kenya, the assumption is that you will work in children's court, in family court, and that sort of thing. And there is positive nuancing towards that. But it also is limiting. I mean, what happens to the rest who want to do different types of work? And it's not just from a personal preference perspective, but also other considerations, including your income capacity, your ability to make change for some of us at scale. You're locked out of that opportunity, and you really have to, push hard to be able to get to the level where a male counterpart is. The second thing, and we've discussed this a lot, is, the balancing of professional life and other obligations. And I will shock you, Susanna, we've had situations where big law firms in Kenya have their partners who essentially are entrepreneurs. The women are not granted maternity leave because they're told you're an entrepreneur. Why do you need an employee benefit? You don't need an employee benefit. And just ignoring that special circumstance of a woman and saying that, if you need 3 months, you will not be paid for those 3 months because you're not working. And anyway, you know the deal because you're an entrepreneur. This is not employment. And so some of those things are very interesting. Or, stories around associates working such long hours as women. And I have one specific story that was very touching. A lady working in big law, and she's working upstairs of a building, say the 19th floor, and she's pregnant, and she has to go downstairs to deliver. It's really, really very strange. And so you'd imagine then for a society that has progressed through the progressive constitution and, pretty much a progressive society, that you'd not be able to see some of those things. Then, of course, the cultural issues. Kenya is pretty much still patriarchal. And if most of you were following the elections in Kenya this year, and it was a huge thing globally. And the matter went up to the Supreme Court. The entire panel of lawyers was here. And that speaks to something. It speaks to a deeper issue. So those are some of the things that women in law, women in entrepreneurship, yes, they're the same issues that women across the spectrum face.
Irene, before I come to you, Sylvia, thank you. You've given us, I think, very deep insight into the corporate context and particularly your field. And I think also breaking this assumption that, this is privileged or these women are empowered. But I'd love to hear, if you don't mind, can I ask you to be a little bit vulnerable and give me an example in this season where some of what you've shared has happened to you, or maybe your struggle right now as a woman, as a partner, functioning in that environment?
Absolutely. Yes, and I'll give you an example as late as last week. And actually, I forgot to mention this, the issue of harassment. And so when we speak about sexual harassment in the workplace, we imagine safeguarding. We imagine things that are very, the degree of severity is completely high. But my own experience is, and I'm very fortunate, Susanna, I must say, that I work in an environment that is safe. As late as last week, you know, you are an entrepreneur, you're seeking out opportunities, you are engaging with the marketplace, and you have leaders or potential clients who essentially cross a certain line. They may not do so to a very high degree of severity where there's abuse, but you can tell that this person is asking for a sexual favor in return of business. And one thing I must mention is that I do have the option of turning it down and saying I'm not willing to do this. But how many women have that option? Majority of the female entrepreneurs in law, assuming they do not have supportive environments or male partners, they'll have no choice. Or they will feel that they have no choice. And what will normally occur is that they would give in. And really, you cannot judge them, so to speak. They're thinking about livelihood. They probably have children and that sort of thing. And so it's not a unique experience. And let me just also match that with the issue of stereotype. When I began my career, the legal fraternity in Kenya has had that issue all along. And in my own mind, it was never an issue. If that happened to me, I never thought about it as an issue until later on when my awareness peaked and I realized, no, this cannot be right. There's certain things that cannot happen. And so my sincere hope is that with these conversations, the level of awareness increases and we're able to, you know, find ways. It's not a silver bullet issue, but with conversations like this, this is a start. And I'm grateful to be able to share my own story.
Sure. Thanks, Sylvia. I think you've raised, you know, a big issue. And I think it's an issue that we probably need to go deeper on in other forums. And I think just the coercion, intimidation, but also the sense of, you know, to whom much is given, much is required. How do we and how do women that are in a place of influence or have the support, how can we stand in the gap for others that can't? And I think that's what came across strongly in what you shared. Moving over to you, Irene, I know that you're working in a very different context in the villages. Tell us, what are some of the realities that you are seeing faced by women?
Thanks. Actually, before I go to the villages, riding on what Sylvia has said, let me just give you a bit of my own corporate experience. And again, I want to go back to what I said earlier, that for me, the gender conversation was always something that I threw away and said, look, women, and again, really speaking to what Anthony was saying, that should we really be talking about gender issues? But I have lived that experience, and it's these conversations that are making me now realize that was the reality of where I was at. My first experience, I had risen in the bank and I had moved to a smaller bank where the person who was in charge, the managing director, had to leave because they had his wife was unwell. So he actually had to leave the organization, and he had left in his succession notes my name as the person that was to take over. And I was to take over as the managing director of that particular bank. This was really a challenge, as I came to realize later on, because I was given the role, but I was not given the authority. I was asked that I would have to report to someone else who was in the hierarchy, was a much lower role. And in trying to understand what that was, the idea was to the public, we will give this position, but internally I would report to this person. So I just couldn't take it, and I actually left. And so many years later on, I took a role in Geneva where I was a global director. And I was the first female in an organization that was started in 1946. I was the first female director. Of course, excited to be in the first world. And things started happening. I realized that I had quite a little scope for making decisions. To a point that I had to be reminded that you do report to someone, therefore you have to do what we want you to do. We had to separate ways. So then I realized that those incidences made me realize that there is something about gender. And I think it has really come through where I'm working in the villages. And I'm working with smallholder farmers. There's a list of smallholder farmers that we started with. We had 148 farmers, and 121 of them were women. The rest were male, which is great. I can tick the box on we are truly working with women, but it is what is happening where these women are working that began to raise an issue for me, because really I realized that they are the ones that are waking up early, they are the ones that are working hard to see that they bring food to the table, and they were still beholden to a cultural expectation of the man being the head of the house, which is fine, no argument about that. The problem then comes in because of how this is translated. And in the village, I have found that in some cases, clearly not all the areas, but in most cases that I've interacted with, the way it is translated is that the woman goes and does the work and makes the money and brings it, and the man spends it. And usually the spending is not for the benefit of the whole family. And there are times when women are actually complaining. Some of the complaints I have received from the women: can we not teach the men so that they become a bit responsible? So the cultural aspect of a man being the head of the family, one of the translation has been that they are being viewed as irresponsible because they are not necessarily taking care of what is happening in the family. In some cases, the women actually find themselves waking up early and going to the fields. Actually, one of the interesting things that I've observed every time I'm driving to our own farm is that no matter how early you go in, you have these fields that are littered with women that are cultivating. And you're just wondering, so where are the men? And then you get this whole story about what the men are doing. And I suppose one of the most challenging aspects of this work for me is that we have a little center that has been modernized, that is more like an outpost. There's a police station there and recreational areas and some shops. And you find that very early, you will find the women are in the fields. But when you go by this place, you'll find even the young boys are actually either playing pool or they've already started drinking. And that becomes the way that they are going to grow up. Their role models are there with them. So for me, it really raises issues of how do we deal with a gender conversation that allows the woman to have the support they need. Because one of the other interesting things is that after the woman has done all this work in the field, they still need to go home and they still need to prepare food for this person that has not participated in any of the activities that lead to bringing food on the table. So in other words, the conversation of women in the rural areas, at least in the area where I'm at, it's almost like the woman is responsible over 75% of the activities that happen around their household, including the life of the person that they call the husband. Now, here is the twist. The twist is that when we meet with these communities and we are asking them how they can help themselves, can they put a structure around what they are doing, can they select a chairperson, can they select the vice, you know, the whole structure. The women will actually go for the men to lead them. the women will volunteer the men to lead them. And there are times that I've called the women aside and I've said, look, you are doing the work. Why are you asking the men to lead you? And sometimes it's two men that are leading 25 women. And what comes out is that the man is recognized as the leader. They are the one that lead us. Of course, I can't go through the dynamic if they chose a woman, what that would be like when they go back home. But there's a sense in which culturally the women have accepted that the men are the leaders. But at the same time, the men have gone off and not necessarily exercising that leadership in terms of seeing that their families are actually fed, and there's real leadership. So I just think there's work to be done there. So really, those are my experiences, both in the corporate world and now that I'm in the villages.
Sure, Irene, thank you. And I'm aware of time, and I wish we had 3 hours, Kerry. You know, what struck me from that conversation was when you also highlighted I had the role, but not the authority. And I'm hearing also there's authority, but not necessarily delivering on the roles and just some of the cultural challenges. And these are, I think, as kingdom minded people, and we're here today, are we tapping into God's heart for these leadership strategies to address this? If I can perhaps, Anthony, ask you to perhaps start, and I'll come back to where you were speaking about this is one of the most fundamental issues to unlock the potential. I think, you know, there are blind spots that we have as with all of us, but what are the blind spots, particularly in the men that are in these places of authority or have the influence, but also how do we unlock this potential? I think there was a McKinsey study that spoke to the fact that if this gender gap in entrepreneurship is truly bridged, it will result in a 360 billion GDP increase by 2025, which is significant. So, how do you believe that leadership, government, corporates, the church can position themselves to unlock this potential? And what are some of the blind spots that perhaps you've even addressed in yourself, Anthony, and that you would want to share for other men in this context so that we can really shift the dial and see this potential unlocked? That was 2 questions.
Thank you. Maybe just to talk to the blind spot first, and for some context, one of the programs that we're involved in East Africa is what's known as a talent investor, where we select some of the highest potential young entrepreneurs or future entrepreneurs in East Africa. It's called Jasiri. And so we work in cohorts of 50 at a time. And the first phase of that talent investor is residential, where these 50 people come together in residence just outside Kigali. And so the point, firstly, is that these are of the highest level of entrepreneurs. We want individuals that are going to create significant high growth enterprises. And what was interesting is we as part of the programming, we have a fireside chat where people come and give input to these entrepreneurs. And so one of our leaders is an extraordinary woman, Tsinkita. She started as what we call a junior program officer more than a decade ago at the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation. And then she's now leading one of our entities, Alan and Jill Gray Philanthropy South Africa, which is one of the more significant philanthropies in South Africa. And she was coming to speak to these entrepreneurs. And then I met up with her afterwards. And what was amazing to me is that she gave the feedback that after the fireside chat, almost all the questions were from the female entrepreneurs at this program at Jasiri, and all of them expressing issues of challenges of gender in terms of what the expectations were, how they were to manage a family and continue as entrepreneurs. And I suppose it showed me so starkly the level of our and my blind spot that, you know, that here was this was the burning issue amongst this cohort of Jasiri entrepreneurs, and yet it was something that we kind of hadn't fully even engaged with, and yet given the slightest opportunity to speak to a relatable leader, you know, suddenly the full extent of these challenges emerge. So I think in terms of blind spots, we've got to understand that that these blind spots exist. That it is, and I think it's the challenge is that we sometimes just ignore it and feel like there's this arrogance that we feel that we do understand things or so I think an attitude of humility and a starting point, a default to realize that there are all these things that we don't fully understand and we don't appreciate, and to kind of be open to that feedback. I found it helpful just to kind of keep listening the whole time and realize that there's so much more that we still need to understand, and we kind of at the very beginning of this journey. And I suppose until we start making it more the default to understand these defaults, that's why we perpetuate all the challenges that we continue to experience. In moving to the second aspect of this opportunity, I think it's extraordinary in the venture capital type space. If one looks at the current level of investment that's happening on the continent, the latest numbers point to somewhere in the region of about 4% of funding is made to female-led founders. I mean, it's not even different. It's like so dramatic that it's, you know, in what world do we have a situation where kind of half the population who are actually proven to be more effective in studies that show the effectiveness of female entrepreneurs are getting 4% of the resources available. I mean, it's just so dramatic that, you know, we kind of have to do something appropriate to respond. And I think part of the answer to kind of how we unlock this is to kind of realize that this isn't just a soft issue. This isn't just an issue that we need to kind of be somehow politically correct about. This is fundamentally affecting the future prosperity of the continent. And I think if we start to kind of see more evidence of the hard impact of this, that's probably the most powerful way to accelerate this. If we kind of start seeing some of these gender-led funds and others kind of showing the actual hard outcomes that are going to come from kind of just breaking down this kind of systemic kind of issue, I think we're going to see the full extent of what's possible as we move this forward.
Thank you, Anthony. And thank you. I think just making it our default to realize we have blind spots, and I think that's a very powerful statement. And I guess also just how dramatic this is. I wonder if Irene and Sylvia and Anthony feel free to add again. You know, how do we see the role of government? How do we see the role of the church? How do we see the private sector? And how can we speak to those of us that are kingdom leaders called to these environments and where we have influence? How do we see their role in really shifting this dial and unlocking this potential?
Let me jump in, and I really want to speak to the 4% that Anthony talked about in terms of resources being given to female-led entrepreneurs, and not necessarily address the 4%, but really talk about businesses that entrepreneurs, women entrepreneurs. And I want to just focus on the low income, and I'm really picking on my experience in the microfinance sector. And the microfinance sector, I think that some of our conversations talk about lending as little as $20, $50, probably going to $1,000, $1,500, and we put our entrepreneurs into groups. So there are a number of things that we need to see that I definitely saw in microfinance that create a barrier. So that solution in itself is loaded with a barrier. There is actually a glass ceiling. And so when you have women in a group or in a village or in a compound, wherever they might be, their first our inclination is to provide for their family. They are probably thinking about the meal that's happening tonight. They're thinking of the meal that's happening tomorrow, next week. They're hardly thinking about what's going to happen next month or next year. So the long-term planning does not necessarily exist in the moment. And the question is, are women able to plan long-term or not? For me, the answer is in the affirmative. However, their situation forces them to start thinking of what's happening today. And I'm reminded of the Bible verse which talks about bread for food and seed for the farmer to go and harvest. So there is short-term and long-term planning. And one of the things that I really think we need to concern ourselves with, especially as believers, is this glass ceiling. Is this ceiling that talks about, yes, you can give a woman $50 and they will make something out of it. It's true. Give them $50, they'll make something out of it. Have we given them the capacity? The same resilience, the same tenacity that the woman has demonstrated in working with $50, if we are able to stretch that and give them the tools that they need to start thinking long-term, that can be done. And I think sometimes that little piece does not necessarily exist. And so you talked about, is there anything that some of the leadership around us can do? Is there anything that the church can do? I would normally want the church to come in because that is credible leadership. That is the kind of leadership that the community will acknowledge. That's the kind of leadership in some of the locations that I've worked in. A church leader can actually tell the community to come and spend a night in church praying. The church leader is not even required to tip anyone for them to come. They will come because their hope is in a God that the church has made available to them. And so part of my question is, are some of these capacities that we need to unleash the women entrepreneurs to really think long-term while they are sorting out things in the immediate? Can some of these tools begin to be deposited within the church, within the people that are in the church? Interestingly, I belong to the church. I bring those skills. There are so many of us that have those skills that belong to churches. So we are not necessarily saying that the minister should stop what they are doing. But is there a way in which they can actually create room for these skills to be passed on to the women so that they can know how to... Let's shift the glass ceiling. That's basically my point here. If we can shift the glass ceiling, the 4%, we are going to see it go up.
Let's shift the glass ceiling. And I think it's how we build capacity, but also our theology and the role modeling that our leaders are doing. Sylvia, any insights around the role of government?
Yes, absolutely. And I think both government and corporates, our institutions generally, and I'll pick up from what Anthony said, I think we're at a point where there's a call for humility to, you know, pause a little bit and say, maybe we don't know the full picture. Maybe we've been doing it wrong. And there has been a lot of, activity around gender, interventions around gender, but are they really meaningful? If you hear the numbers that we're talking about, the 4%, it's not making a difference. And so starting from that baseline again, and just looking at what can we shift in terms of the interventions we are seeing in place. So is it just about filling seats in an organization? No. It's about what Irene said, you know, creating, how do you empower, how do you provide authority once that person is on that seat? If it's within the entrepreneurship space, I think there's so much to be done there. From a funding perspective, how do our funders recognize these challenges and these issues that both Irene and Anthony were speaking about and create programs and interventions that suit that? I'll give you an example, Susanna. 2 days ago, I was at a forum and this impact fund was saying that, they have a program that requires their beneficiaries to provide matching funds. And all the women were unable to fit that criteria because they need that money for their day-to-day. And so when they looked at their program portfolio, the only people who were able to access that funding was the male entrepreneurs. So looking at some of these shifts, they may take a lot of risk. They may take a lot of shift in how we do business, but it does seem like a necessary requirement. Then I think one of the biggest things and the most impactful is networking and creating a space for recognizing the issues, recognizing the gaps and how to fill those gaps. There has not been, in my experience, strong network support for women entrepreneurs. It's still not yet there. There may be fragmented interventions here and there, but nothing that will allow women to really flourish or to get to the place that we want to see.
I'm going to see if Anthony has any additions to this question, perhaps on some of the structural changes or private sector insights. And then what I'd like us to do is to shift gear to perhaps answer some of the many questions that are coming through the audience. And thank you to everybody that's joined this session once again. If you came in a bit later, it's fantastic to have you. And we've had a fantastic panel, Sylvia, Irene, and Anthony. And so we'd like to give space for your questions to them in our last few minutes. But Anthony, any additions to looking at the role of the church, private sector, or government in addressing some of the unlocking this potential?
Not much. I think the main thing is just to realize that this is an extraordinarily distorted situation that we've arrived in. And so there's this kind of incredibly significant systemic issue. And therefore, I think we need to be equally bold and equally courageous in terms of the extent of the interventions that are going to need to normalize and to reach some sort of equilibrium around these things. I think there's so many kind of blockages. We just touched on the issue, Sylvia, around networks, and there's so many kind of entrenched systems that aren't even that clearly visible that are preventing progress in this area. And so I think, you know, we just have to be far more intentional in how we take this forward.
So I'm going to pull out a couple of questions, and I will read these out, and Irene and Sylvia and Anthony, you can think through these and then answer them when you feel comfortable, and I'm happy to repeat them. So for Irene, thank you for your insights. From your experience, how can women balancing work, family, working crazy long hours and really turning that noise and life off, how can they flourish at work as African leaders? And that is from Juliet in Uganda. For Anthony, how do men who want to empower women deal with having the gender bias? Is this an issue of behavior change or systems change at a higher level? And that's from Gerald. And then Sylvia, if you can tackle, how do we deal with the systemic corruption? And what is your wisdom for women that are caught up in it? You can pop when you're hot.
Okay, I'll go first, Susanna, if you don't mind. And the question is around how do we help women balance? It's really a work-life balance. And I think in the village, you cannot even measure it in terms of you start work at 8, because they start work when they start work, and normally it's about 4 a.m. How can they balance? For me, I think that when we start talking about a toolkit, when we start talking about empowering women, one of the things that becomes very clear, and this is very topical, this work-life balance is something that's being discussed over and over again, because it is an issue. And so in my mind, if we are going to empower women, especially in the rural areas, in that toolkit, we are also talking about how do they balance their time. Now, balancing time is a conversation that doesn't exist if it's not contextualized. So it really needs to be contextualized in terms of the activities that the woman finds themselves doing. And those activities will definitely send the woman to talk about their plan within the family context. Who does what? Because I think we need to accept, I will say it as a woman, that there are times that I will do what needs to be done. I rarely stop to ask for help because I just think that things need to be done. This needs to be done. And so I'm going to do it. So how do we equip the woman to know how far they can go? How do we equip the woman to even know how to delegate within the situation that they are in? So in my view, the work-life balance needs to happen, but it can only happen within the context of empowering the people we are working with on how they should plan their lives as well as the activities that make money for them.
How do we empower women with a gender bias question? So I think what's interesting is of the five significant philanthropic entities in the gray group, four at the moment are currently led by women, four out of the five. And I think part of it is just kind of realizing that is, I think that we kind of almost need to kind of believe in that reality up front, that there is no kind of limitation on the effectiveness of female leadership in this case, and to kind of really just kind of just allow it to realize the fullness of its potential. And I think there's some practical suggestions that one could take in terms of kind of accommodating the realities of families and other areas and not prejudicing that in any way. But I think in this case, the gray philanthropy group is so advantaged by harnessing the fullness of that leadership. And I think, again, I think it's seeing the outcomes of this in hard, real progress terms, as opposed to kind of make it feeling like you're having to make some sort of concessions or that you're doing something because it's the right thing to do. It's this is such a fundamental issue that we kind of we're losing out on the full possibilities of our organizations and progress when we don't kind of allow this to flourish. So I think it's maybe just reminding ourselves of that and also kind of checking ourselves, because there's As a male leader, maybe it's sometimes more comfortable being in a context where it's more male orientated and kind of understanding and just being sensitive and aware to contexts and situations where you might be alienating or excluding without even full awareness. But I think that the primary understanding must be what is possible when you do this right, as opposed to kind of doing it out of some sort of motivation of compliance or other reasons.
Amazing. Sylvia.
Yes, thank you. So the question is pretty hard. It's a difficult one, how to deal with systemic corruption. I face that every day in my line of work, and I still don't have the answer, to be honest. But if I could just share some of my experiences, the role of men and their ability to galvanize around women is incredible. And that is one thing that I feel that even as women through this journey, that intentionality around men as well. So it should be two way in my view, where you look for that level of support and recognition of the role that men play is critical. From a general perspective, the answer is going to be long and difficult. And it goes back down to that intentionality, the networking that we spoke about, so that even where you're working against the grain and, opportunities are hard to come by because of some of these systemic issues, what are we doing as kingdom businesses or as women to recognize those issues and support each other to get where we want to go? It's not going to be an easy journey, but a worthwhile one, in my view.
Thank you, Sylvia. I'm aware of time, and we've got some fantastic questions here. And unfortunately, we won't get to answer all of them with our panel today. But perhaps I can pull one out and maybe break some rules and give a little bit of input myself. This question is, why is the consideration of leadership based on gender versus competency, competence in families or in communities in the workplace? And I'm, you know, as we are speaking, I think we're looking at the cultural dynamics and the just the barriers that women face. But I think one also mustn't make the assumption that women in the workplace are all necessarily with a partner. We know that many households are led by single women. That's the majority. And then we're, for those that have partners, they're the real barriers and the cultural barriers that we've discussed today. And I think I have the extraordinary privilege of being married to a husband who's really hands-on, and we lean into that, and we're both leading. And just so aware of the privilege that that is, and that that's a very unusual context. But I'd love to put that question to all of us. Just, you know, how do we see this issue of competency versus gender being tackled? What are our words that we want to go out from each of you today to this group who've come here, because this is a topic on their hearts and this is a topic on God's heart? Irene is smiling. I'm going to hand over to her.
Sure. I'm smiling because the thought that immediately comes into my mind is that gender, there's very little we can, from a factual perspective, gender is, you know, I'm this gender, Anthony is that gender, Susanna, Silva is that gender. What we do with it is are the choices that we need to make. The issue of competence, and this thought really just landed on me, isn't competence a choice? And I really say that from the perspective of, we all start our life's journey picking up tools that are going to serve us as we move on this life's journey. And as we are picking up these tools, some of the things that my parents taught me as I went into society, I recognized that I could improve on certain of those activities, on the tools that I have in my toolbox. And one of the things that comes into my face as I am in the marketplace, I am in society, is this whole issue of competence. It's this whole issue of how I do what I do, how I look after the children that I have, how I manage to juggle the balls that have been given to me. And so part of me is really thinking that it is a choice, but it is a choice that comes out of recognizing that there's always a better version of you. And therefore, that better version of you, you are the author, you are the one that needs to make it happen. How do you make it happen if thus far you are where you are today? And do you say, and again, I want to pick on the networks that Sylvia talked about. How do you leverage the resources, the networks? How do you leverage even some of the things that we are able to learn through books, through the various organizations that we interact with? How do we make the choice to actually identify what our competence gaps are? Understand that we do have those gaps. Identify what they are and look to where you're going to get the tools to make yourself better. Now, when you bring it in the gender conversation, and I'm going through this thought process as I speak, I'm asking myself this question in the context of the rural communities that I'm working in. Don't the husbands, the males, and I want to say that sometimes there are women also who do not necessarily behave in the way that the general population do. Don't they do have the same choice? Can they make the choice to better themselves. There is a choice when they wake up in the morning, are they going to go and help in the farm or are they going to go drinking? That's a choice. So I would like to say that we can actually talk about competence in the context of gender. And if the man has been recognized, especially in the rural setup, as the leader, then we need to include leadership as well. That's my take.
My take on that question is there's really also need to think through it a little bit more around whether it's an issue of competence or an issue of stereotype. And if there's any work to do, deliberate and intentional work to do around changing stereotype narratives. And it could be in various ways. You know, this forum, for one, actively profiling women, their stories and different perspectives, but there could be more to be done. And so my own experience has seen very, very competent women suffering at the hands of stereotype, and there must be something to be done from a stereotype perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think just the very fact that there can even be a question about leadership being about competence versus gender shows the extent of the issue and how deeply entrenched it is culturally and in so many other contexts. And so, yeah, I think that shows the work that lies ahead. But again, just to re-emphasize the message, I think if we build our responses based on the opportunity that this can unlock, I think we can have far more success in driving this forward. That you know, there's so much that can be gained from unlocking the fullness of this opportunity. We will have more competent leaders as opposed to just gender-based leaders, right from the very grassroots of society through to the highest levels of leadership. And I think the point is that we've got to an abnormal situation, and therefore for a period of time there are going to be abnormal responses are going to be needed to recalibrate and get us back on track. But my last thought on this is just that, you know, I think as we do this, I think we must be careful that we don't set ourselves up in opposition to each other. You know, ultimately, the ultimate picture, as one sees in marriage, is this extraordinary potential of two people working together to co-create something that would never be possible just on their own. And so as much as we need these interventions, I think we must be careful to not set ourselves up in opposition to each other, but actually be looking to harness the fullness of what we can both bring to the situation.
Thank you so much to everyone. Wow, I think we have time for one more question. And apologies if you have sent through questions and we don't get to answer them in this forum. I'm hoping that we can address them in other articles or keep this conversation going on the Zawani platform. In your experience, does the same imbalance with regards to venture investment funding allocated to women in business also apply to women in the ministry space? And that is to me, but also to others here. So I think if we can just have any insights on that question from the panel, and then I think I will add to that and we will hand over to Kerry. So how are we finding that this imbalance in the workplace is working itself out perhaps in our more overtly ministry context? I think some of us may, from a theological perspective, say everything's ministry, the workplace is ministry. And that's not today's debate. But are we seeing this imbalance playing out in ministry in the church? Is it as bad? Is it less?
I will go. Not that I have an answer, but until the question was asked, I had actually not considered it.
Sure.
So it's a good thing that it is being asked. And all I can say is I want to delve into it a little bit more. The only observation I make, though, is that in my universe, I find that in ministry, well, let me just talk about in a church setup, you in terms of gender, you then have, it's almost like it's really the domain for men. And so you find the women are very much active in the ministry, but definitely not at that level of leadership. Why that is so, I couldn't give you an answer, but definitely something that I would like to go and delve in and learn a little bit more of what's happening in that space.
Any inputs from the two of you? Otherwise, we will close. Go for it, Sylvia.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite a thought-provoking question. Never thought about it before as well. Having worked with, church in various ways, I do still believe that there's still work for improvement. I may not have clarity in my mind around what that would look like, but recognizing the depth and, of the issues that we've spoken about, ministry and church play a critical role in society. And so they certainly do have some role to play in supporting this agenda.
And I'll go back to the, Anthony, any elephants in the room you want to raise in that space before we close?
I think it's a great question. Again, I don't think we have as clear data on this. My suspicion is that the distortion is there, but perhaps not as extreme as it is in the commercial markets. It's probably.
Thank you. And I think as a entrepreneur myself, or someone that's raising, funding in the nonprofit space, I think it my experience would be that it does play out. And I think one just finds themselves sometimes in a space where you feel like you've got to work a little bit harder to give context, or you maybe get put in a box quickly and you can sense, okay, I'm being stereotyped, or I'm not being taken seriously, or and I think that it was something Sylvia raised earlier, just around those of us that are empowered or maybe have a little bit more support. I think we're always on an empowerment journey. Just need to be aware of maybe others that don't and may shrink back and may not be as bullshy as some of us here today would be in that situation, just to perhaps speak up a little bit more or take time to have a space, to fight for a space to be heard. And thank you to everyone. I think this is obviously a very important topic, one that I think if we can really understand the significance of getting this right and its impact on the continent and its impact on creative solutions and redemptive solutions being unlocked, I think that will be really exciting. So we've opened up a beautiful can of worms today, and I'm going to hand over to Kerry on that note.
Thank you, Susanna. Thank you to our incredible panel for just taking us through a tough conversation. So really appreciate you guys being bold enough to just share some of your testimonies, some of your stories, some of your journey that you've all been on. We really appreciate it. And I love a few things that I really enjoyed was, one, that there's an ownership on all of us to go on a learning journey. Irene, I love what you said there, that, we can all improve, we can all be better. And so how do we all do that? No matter which gender we are, no matter which cultural group we are, no matter what age we're at, that we're constantly intentional about learning. One of the things I love is that the idea of being redemptive is that I think God wants to fix systems that are broken. And so what is broken in the system, and how do we truly breathe life into some of these spaces where people are experiencing challenges and aren't able to flourish and be in their fullness in spaces? And so I think that speaks to you, and I love what you said, Anthony, there's none of this should be about being against one another, but actually for one another. And so how together, sons and daughters of God, how do we together really just unlock some of the beauty and potential that God is really wanting to just have blossom on our continent? And so I think it's an exciting discussion and something that we can really just keep diving into and hopefully feel challenged to keep diving into in our different areas of work, and maybe just try and ask more questions and see if we notice more things in those spaces. So thank you so much for all your insights, your conversation today. We really enjoyed it. And I love the fact that this is also a multi-layered conversation. So as we were talking, I was thinking, there's layers of bias, but you can't always put it to that. Sometimes it is that, and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's style, sometimes it's cultural nuances, sometimes it's so I think it's all about just unlocking that potential of sons and daughters of God and how we flourish in community together. And so exciting, if we as believers can get it right, what a testimony it can be and what an example it can be to others on the continent. So thank you for taking the time out today, an hour and a half with us, to chat through this conversation. Encourage your friends and family to engage in these discussions too. And then just a couple of things we want to highlight. So if you've enjoyed today's discussion, you are welcome to join us. We have exchange groups and business leaders like who've been on the call today, meeting around the continent and having these kinds of discussions. We have wonderful course material that people go through. And so please contact us if you're wanting to join one of our exchange groups. And then you would have seen on the slides, we have a podcast series that's actually just come to an end. So you can listen to all 27 episodes called Monday Christian. It has been an incredible series that two of our Zawani business leaders put together, a theologian and an entrepreneur. And so fascinating insights that they bring into the discussion. So I encourage you to listen to that podcast. And we have a new podcast starting in the middle of March. It will be going live, I think, on the 14th of March, and that's around business and justice. So you're welcome to keep an eye for that. And then our next At the Lake is on the 14th of June. So we'll be sending out emails and information around that. So put that in your diary if you enjoyed today's At the Lake. Hopefully we'll have some more really good discussions on topics that we don't generally like to go to. Thanks so much, everyone, and have a fantastic day. And again, a really, really big thank you to our panel. Thank you, Susanna. Thank you, Irene. Thank you, Anthony. And thank you, Sylvia. You guys have been absolutely amazing. We really appreciated you joining us today. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening today. If you would like to hear more conversations on the topic of redemptive business in Africa, visit Ziwani's website at www.ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.